clear towards the end of Perek Yud Aleph, in the middle of a discussion regarding Yiftach's oath, which into which his daughter gets caught, and ultimately Yiftach, both from his own perspective as well as from his daughter's urging, fulfills the oath which he had committed to God, and does the oath to his daughter. Vayaslo et nidro asher nadar. We've talked a little bit about the euphemism. When we first started this discussion, we said initially that there were two general approaches to the issue of Yiftach's oath. One was the approach taken by the vast majority of Midrashic sources that take the oath quite literally. That which will walk out of my house, I will sacrifice to God, or he or she, whomever walks out of my house, I will make an offering to God. Some sources even suggesting that he intended, because of his pagan upbringing, intended that to mean a human sacrifice, and either he was expecting somebody else to walk out of his house, or wasn't expecting his daughter, or perhaps was expecting that because they heard the oath, they would avoid coming out of the house, or whatever it was, that was his intent. Other Midrashic sources mitigated a little bit by suggesting that he had really meant some kind of an animal sacrifice, but God wanted to demonstrate to him that he didn't formulate the oath correctly, and so he tripped him by demonstrating that that could have referred to a human being as well, and it was Yiftach's own mistaken sense of priorities and values and pagan upbringing that gave him that sense that he had to force him into actually bringing her as a sacrifice on the altar, or on some altar. I really doubt he brought her as an offering in the Mishkan, because that would not have gone over. I don't think the Kohanim would have let that go, get away with that. To the Ramban, who suggested that that in fact he was taking some kind of oath in the middle of battle, which was very normal, kind of cherem, but misunderstood the integrity of what that means when the Torah says that that a king or a general in the heat of battle takes an oath of cherem, as it was saw by Yehoshua, it was saw by Yericho. He thought that meant that whatever the king says goes. Didn't realize that that it refers specifically to the destruction of the enemy, not to the pagan context of human sacrifice. All of this we called school one, approach number one, meaning that whatever his intention was, whether his intention was pagan or his intention was altruistic, the result was that he took this poor innocent girl and literally slaughtered her on the altar in the name of some perverted sense of religiosity. That is certainly the literal reading of the text, and I think that's how Chazal saw it in the Gemara, in the Medrash, Rabbah, and the various Midrashim that we saw, and has, as the Ramban vehemently defends the interpretation in this context. What I suggested to you also was that on the flip side, there's a school of Mefarshim, and here I would have to say the majority of the Mefarshim, that seem to reinterpret the story. They will say that it's pshat. I'm not convinced that it's the literal reading of the text, but nonetheless, I will tell you that that's the pshat of the story. That in fact, nobody died from this story, except maybe the Ammonites and the enemy. Right, but that in fact we misread the details of what took place. And that brings us to our second set of sources. Now I've redone the source page because I've reordered them, resequenced the texts and added a few things. So this is a modified version of the source page I gave out last class. So my apologies, you can if you wish, or you can hold on to it, or you can put it into a recycle. Hmm.
Do I have to go into Seamus?
I don't think so. I think we can go into Recycle. So what we did last week was the first school of thought, which is essentially the first page. I've divided the two approaches between the two halves of the page. So source 1, 2, now what is source 3 and 4, the Gemara in Tainis, Bereishis Rabba, Medrash Ben Sira, and the Ramban. That's all the sources that we did last week. We turn the page over and we get to this agenda. For some reason this got cut off a little bit. I don't know why. Alright. So the approach taken by Ibn Ezra, Radak, Mitzvah David, Abarbanel, Malbim, just pretty much the whole school of the Mikro Kedolot, is to understand the key phrase. Let's go back to the oath. Let's just reread the Pesukim for a moment, go back to at least the key verses that the Ramban addresses. In the midst of battle, Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Chaf Tet, through Lamed Aleph. Vatehiya Yiftach, everybody have it? Vatehiya Yiftach Ruach Hashem, Ve'avot Agilad Ve'et Menashe, Ve'avot Mitzpe Gilad U'Mitzpe Gilad Avar B'nei Amon. Ruach Hashem, we talked about Yiftach is in the midst of battle, spirit of courage, divinely inspired courage, God is with him, and he's running into battle. Vayidar Yiftach neder la'Hashem vayomah. Yiftach made a neder, an oath, to Hashem, and said, Im naton titen et b'nei amon biyadi. Translated loosely, if you will give b'nei amon into my hands, v'haya hayotzei asher yetzei midaltei veti likrati b'shuvi b'shalom b'nei amon. And here we have the pronoun issue. Is it that or is it who? V'haya hayotzei, that which will emerge, or he or whom will emerge, depending on how you understand the pronoun, will walk out of the doors of my house to greet me as I return peacefully from the battle with b'nei amon. Vayala Hashem v'alitiu ola. Translate the last four words.
Vahaya was Hashem.
No, Vahaya will be.
It will be.
Vahaya, he will be. Vahayala Hashem. It will be, or you will be to Hashem. V'alitiu ola. It will be offered
for a burnt offering.
V'alitiu ola. Then he comes home. Pasuk Lamed Dalet, Vayavo Yiftach HaMitzpah El Beto, Vihine Vito Yotzet Likrato Betupim Uvim Cholot. Who greets him? Who walks out of his house to greet him? His daughter. Circle dancing and timbrels and instruments and singing. Verak Yichida En Lo Mimenu Ben Ovat. So whether or not she's his only child is again problematic in terms of the pronoun, because in the Hebrew it says ein lo mimenu, which employs two masculine pronouns here when you're dealing with two subjects, one male, one female. Ein lo mimenu, problematic. We'll come to that in a moment. Vayhi chiroto ota vayikrat begada vayomar aha biti achrei hichra'atini ve'at hayit ba'ochri. Tears his garment. Sad, he says, you have been my trouble. You are my trouble. You are the source of my anguish here. Because v'anochi patziti pi al Hashem v'lo ochal ashuv. I open up my mouth to God. I took an oath. I can't retract. So he clearly sees what happened as some tragic moment. Whatever the understanding is, certainly everything we've set up until now is that he saw this as a literal, I will sacrifice whatever walks out of my house. She walks out, he's thinking, sacrifice. That's how we've seen it up until now. But whatever interpretation we're about to give, clearly he sees this as a moment of anguish. And she says, V'tomer elav, avi patzita t'picha el Hashem, aseli kashi etzami picha, after you've opened your mouth, then you have to do what your mouth has said. God was good for you. God, good to you. God brought you this great victory. Certainly, you have no choice.
I have a question.
Can you hold it for one second? Let me finish the two psukim, and then I'll give you a chance to ask your question. So she said to him, "Do whatever you've said. However, do this first." Harpeh mimeni shnayim chodashim, leave me for 2 months. Ve'elcha v'yiradati al harim ve'evke al betulai anochi v'reotai. Give me 2 months to mourn my virginity, which until now we've understood to mean that if she's going to be offered as a sacrifice on the altar, she's also single, she's young, and it means that her death is the end of a line, right? She doesn't have any children. She has no legacy. So the mourning is not only on her, for her death, but also for her, the destruction of any future that she would have. So he says, fine. They cry over her virginity on the mountains. She returns after 2 months, which is interesting. She comes back voluntarily. You can imagine she'd run away. And he fulfilled his oath. Her never having known a man. And from that point forward, there was a annual commemoration, 4 days a year, the daughters of Israel would go to cry over Bat Yiftach. Shelley had a question.
My question is, if this was an inappropriate oath, why was he successful in that? Why was it acceptable to Hashem to help him be successful in that?
If this was a success, a unacceptable oath, why did God accept the oath and be successful in battle? For every approach that we've given, you're probably going to have to modify the answer to that question. In other words, if it's a pure pagan oath and pure paganism is in his mind, then you'd have to assume that it's God is testing him, challenging him. If his intention was good, but the result was not, and therefore his paganism got the best of him at the end, then at least at the point of the oath, at the moment of battle, his intentions were pure. Mm-hmm. So depending on how you look at what transpired, you'd have to modify the answer to that question. Certainly to the Radak, as we're going to see, there isn't a problem, because the Radak sees the oath as a very positive thing.
How can you accept the statement, "I cannot recant"? We've been always.
Right, so I haven't addressed the question of the ability to renege or annul an oath. I haven't addressed that question at all. I've left it intentionally for afterwards, because it's a postscript to the story. In other words, we're going to deal with the story first, and then we'll deal with, after I get back from our 2 week or 3 week hiatus, we'll deal with the question of the oath and the legality of such an oath, and whether or not he had the ability to recant.
Well, I guess I'm disturbed by the words, "I cannot recant." I mean, why
it's
not?
It's a mitzvah in the Torah, mitzvah svatecha tishmor, that which comes out of your mouth, guard. Yeah, there's a mitzvah in the Torah to fulfill an oath. You take an oath, you have to fulfill it. There is a concept of hatavatim. But again, a lot will depend on what you perceive the oath to be. Assuming that the oath traps him into a world of paganism, so we have an issue. Why doesn't he recant? But we'll see in a moment. The Radak wants to suggest that the oath is a very beautiful thing. And he was absolutely right in fulfilling it. But we have to understand what fulfilling that oath means. So let's take a look at the Radak. We're dancing around the issue. Let's deal with it head on. V'ha'alitiyu ola. Everything revolves around four words. Everything everything revolves around four words, the definition of his oath. Hayotzei midaltei beiti mikrati vishuvi vishalom. Right? That's the context, that's the subject. Hayotzei midaltei beiti likrati uvaya hayotzei asher yetzei midaltei beiti likrati vishuvi vishalom. What is the that's the subject of the oath. What is the application of the oath?
Sacrifice.
V'haya la'Hashem v'ha'alitihu ola. Which, of course, we said, how do you take a human being and offer them as a sacrifice? Agreed? Says the Radak, Dat razal bazeh yadua. The rabbi's opinion on this matter is well known. To which he means, to which he refers to,
that he sacrificed
her. In other words, a literal reading of the text is how Chazal, in all the Midrashim, understand this passage. Now, the Aleph Aleph here is a reference to the Ibn Ezra. Mm-hmm. Ibn Ezra Zal Piresh. The Ibn Ezra's understanding of this verse, however, is a little different. V'ha'alitiyu, in the word v'ha'alitiyu, havav bimkom o. The letter vav, which we translate more often than we should perhaps as, quote, and, in this context means or. V'haya la'Hashem, or ha'alitiyu ola. This vav is or. Mm-hmm. How does that work?
I'll show you. One second. Let's finish.
Yes. Oh, yes. Okay. Absolutely. Upiresh. V'hayala Hashem hekdesh. V'hayala Hashem. It will be kodesh. It will be belong to the temple. Im einora uil ola. If it's something which, that which comes out of my house, which I can't bring as a sacrifice, so then I'll make it hekdesh, I'll make it designated to God. It'll be, there's a way, you can give things to the temple that can't be put on the altar. There's a concept called hekdesh, a concept called berakah bayit. I can donate money to the Beit HaMikdash, to the Mishkan. Money can't be brought on the altar, but there's a property, there's a wealth, there's that which belongs to the temple, that belongs to the Kohen. So if it's something which can be brought on the altar, v'ayala Hashem, which can't be brought on the altar, v'ayala Hashem, then I'll designate it as hektish. Or, v'alitiyu ola, im ra'uil ola. And if it's appropriate as a sacrifice, if a cow walks out of the house, or a chicken, or a goat, then it'll be a sacrifice. Now, Jackie asks for an example. Ukumo ze'avav. Another example of this kind of vav. Here's a verse. Make aviv ve'imo mot yumat. Make aviv ve'imo means you hit your mother. Translate it. Make aviv ve'imo mot yumat. He who smites
father.
Make aviv ve'imo mot yumat. Translate it. He who smites mother or father. Right. In other words, we intuitively translate it there as or. Because nobody's going to suggest that in order to be guilty of hitting a parent, you have to hit both parents. Right? The letter vav is a very complex letter in Hebrew grammar, and it has multiple meanings. Sometimes it's not even translated. Sometimes it's serving a grammatical purpose, such as the vav ha'hipuch, like the reversal vav, which we mistakenly translate as and, but in fact is part of the grammatical structure of a verse, or of a phrase, a verb. So here, makeh aviv v'imo, the letter vav, can mean or. O imo, v'o imo, it means or is mother. So says Ibn Ezra. V'yafepiresh. This is a beautiful interpretation. V'chein nira me'apasuk ki lo hemita. And if you look carefully at the text, you'll see that it indicates that he never killed her. That's an absurd interpretation, says the Radak. Why? She'amar v'afke'al nafshi. It doesn't say that she said to her father, give me 2 months so that I can go out and cry over my life that's about to end. It says, v'afke'al bitulai. It says, I will cry over my virginity. Lo'ot ki lo emita. He never killed her. So what did he do to her? So what does v'hayala Hashem mean? In other words, if it's a person, v'hayala Hashem. If it's an animal, then v'aliti ola. And this vav is an or. So if it ends up being a person, in this case, bat yiftach. So what does v'hayala Hashem mean, and what did he actually do to her?
Give him none.
Right, that's what the Radak says. That's exactly what the Radak says. One second. One step at a time. V'haya, so what happened? Kumo she'amar I lost the words for a second. But the result was ach lo yada ish. The result was that she was to remain for the remainder of her life celibate. V'hi lo yada ish. Kumo she'amar v'hi lo yada ish. Uma she'amar gam kein. Now when he actually fulfills the oath, we pointed this out already. This euphemism is employed. V'yas la et nidro asher nadar. He fulfilled the oath that he had taken. Why doesn't it just say that he brought her as an offering? Gam kein v'yas la et nidro asher nadar v'lo amar v'yale ola. It doesn't say that he offered her. Lo'ot ki pusha haita. To demonstrate that in fact what meant was that she would be pusha. What is pusha?
Separated.
V'zeo et nidro asher nadar. V'haya la Hashem. That designated to God, service to God. Ki kach nira lefi pshutei ha-psukim. That's the pshat, says the Radak. V'divrei Razal, as far as the rabbis in the Medrash go that say that he actually killed her, im kabbalai bi'adam olenu lekabla. If they had such a Kabbalah, such a Masoret, such a tradition, so we have no choice to accept it. But if you're dealing with biblical text interpretation, this, says the Radak, is closer to the pshat of the story. Says the Radak essentially that Mehilo Yada'ish, the whole story here revolves around her status as a single unmarried woman. How many times does that become the focus of the story? It says, Pasuk Lamed Zayin, Harpe mimeni shnei chodashim ve'echa ve'iradeti al arim ve'evke al betulai. Pasuk Lamed Chet, Vatelech hi v'reyotea v'tefk al betuleha. Pasuk Lamed Tet, Vayhi miket shnayim chodeshim v'atashuv al aviha v'yas la et nidro asher lada v'hi lo yada ish. So 3 psukim in a row, the focus is on livkot al betuleha v'hi lo yada ish, on her status as single, unmarried, and so she shall remain for the remainder of her life. Right? To quote Shakespeare, get thee to a nunnery. All right. Which, of course, raises umpteen questions. Not the least of them being...
What? Where'd she go?
Well, where did she go?
Went to the mountain.
That's, okay, I think actually secondary to the primary question.
Right. What kind of tradition was this?
Yeah, where do we have such a tradition that to serve God, you be celibate? And you have to wonder how much outside influence is affecting the interpretation of the Ibn Ezra, who lives in Spain, Radak, who lives in the Middle Ages in Spain, the Barbanel, who lives in the Middle Ages in Spain, the Malbim, who lives in 19th century Europe. You have to stop and wonder how much outside influence is affecting this,
unless it was
this
in
school
the
of thought.
Tradition and the Christians took it from a Jewish position that we just have lost someone.
Well, then you'd have to show it to me. Because the halacha is, and the Torah is very clear, that the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur has to be married. And a Kohen Gadol who's not married is invalid from being serving as the Kohen Gadol. And the halacha of a nazir
is time limited.
Number one, is time limited. Number two, there's no restriction on the nazir as far as marriage goes.
So
the nazir is only restricted in terms of drinking wine and becoming tameh. There's no restriction whatsoever on the nazir as far as marriage is concerned.
So you think that all of the celibacy comes from a pagan source originally?
I would, if historically, either comes from a pagan source or at least, you know, clearly from a Christian source. But there's no reference to it.
There was like the Essenes, and I mean, there were all of those groups that were, some of them believed in celibacy.
So the question is where that comes from in the Second Temple period, mm-hmm. but it doesn't exist in the Tanakh, and it doesn't exist in the First Temple period, certainly.
Still better than death.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Radak is saying this in a very positive sense. He's saying that this oath, which explains why he never tries to annul this oath. According to the Radak, it's a wonderful thing. It's a bracha. He makes his daughter a gift to the Kohen, or a gift to the temple, or a gift to the operation of service to God.
What are you supposed to be doing?
Praying, meditating, whatever. Right. Take a look in Pasuk Lamed Tet, where he interprets the phrase "Vayaslat Nidro Asher Nadar." Look at the source of Radak, two paragraphs down. Vayaslat Nidro Asher Nadar, on the source page. Sheya Sheasala Bait. What does it mean? He fulfilled the oath. He built her a house. V'hechnisa sham, put her into this house. V'hayta sham pusham ibnei adam, and there she was separated from the rest of civilization. U'midarkei ha'olam, separated from the routine of the world, which is a euphemism for saying that she was celibate. V'haya chok b'Yisrael, what was this tradition, this custom in Israel, 4 days a year? She had visitation rights 4 days a year.
She was imprisoned.
Very strange world. But that, says Radak, is how to understand the yeah. Now,
how are these proportionment in order?
Would you rather
is
just
worse
die?
Than
yeah.
what people think is the most important. Where are these people?
These are the classic.
So who's on top?
Oh, I don't think, well, once you're done with Mefosh, I don't think anyone, one is particularly
so
more on top than the other.
So believe in the Radak? I mean, really
this is the Radak, Ibn Ezra. I didn't bring you all of the quotes, because I didn't, you know, you don't need more than one to see the, right? But they all took this approach, except for the Ramban, pretty much. They all took the approach that is being articulated here, because the alternative was worse. So at least this gave an interpretation that had some context that left her Nebuch alive.
It's very foreign.
But it's very foreign. And that's precisely the challenge the Ramban offers. So before we try to understand this a little bit more, I thought I would share with you the Ramban's critique of Radak. You were all very kind in saying that this is foreign. The Ramban was not so kind, because in the Middle Ages, I just showed this, I was doing something on Sunday with a group of students that I teach, and we had an example of one of the commentaries of Rashbam, who quotes, not by name, but by context, a commentary of Rashi, and then says, Sheker who?
Whoa.
Now, remember that Rashi is the Rashbam's grandfather. Rashbam is the grandson of Rashi. So you have to remember that in the Middle Ages, that's how the Mefarshim wrote. They wrote intensely, they wrote with sharp critique.
Honestly.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that they wouldn't, you know, grandson wouldn't sit and go to his grandfather's, you know, chasna or something. It's just, you have to put it into context. That's how they wrote. So here's the Ramban. In reference to, now this is the Ramban, we saw the Ramban last week. It's the Ramban of Chumash and Pashat Bechukotai on the story of the Cherem. He interprets the story of Yiftach, and then I left this piece out, I put it here. He continues with an address to the interpretation of others. Do not be caught up in the vain nonsense of Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra. Ha'omer, who says, and now he paraphrases, Ki perush v'ha'alitiu ola means o v'ha'alitiu. Lomar im ha'yotze midalte beti ish o isha v'haya la Hashem kodesh, ye perush midalchei ha'olam, la'amod l'sharet b'shem Hashem b'tfila v'hodot l'alokim, v'im ye davar u'i likarev a'alenu ola. Without translating it again, essentially paraphrases the Ibn Ezra or the Radak's interpretation. He says, do not be caught up in this nonsense. Meaning, that he built her a house and that she was isolated and that he fed her there and he provided for her there, but that she was separated from humanity. Says the Ramban, right in the middle of this paragraph, Ve'ele divrei ruach. This is, we've called it hevel, and now we've called it ruach. Hot air, nonsense, stupidity in modern terms. This is nonsense. Why? Ki im nadash yel Hashem, if his oath is v'hayal Hashem, if that's what it means, even according to his interpretation, even the Shitato, Yalla Hashem, then, enenu sheye parush, that doesn't mean that they would be celibate or separated. What's the only example we have in all of Tanakh of somebody being designated or given to the temple, as a human being given over to the temple? Chana's son, Shmuel. She takes an oath that if God will give her a son, unitativ la Hashem koyemei chayav. And he quotes that verse. Yeh kmo Shmuel, shamra imon, unitativ la Hashem. Now, what does that mean? I will give him over to God in case of Shmuel. Well, then when he became a Navi, but she didn't know he would become a Navi. But what did she do to him? She brought him to the temple. She brought him to the Kohen. And he lived in the temple. He served the Kohen as an apprentice, even though he wasn't a Kohen. He was a Levi. But he ends up being part of the temple operation, Kodesh Lashem. More importantly, did that oath have anything to do with celibacy? How do I know? Maybe he was like a monk who was celibate, couldn't marry. You know, how do you know that Unitativ Lashem doesn't mean, prove to me that it doesn't mean celibacy? Because Shmuel has sons. Correct. Shmuel has children. Right? In other words, the concept in Tanakh of Unitativ Lashem has nothing to do with celibacy. That is clearly not a Jewish tradition. It means that he served in the temple. It doesn't mean that he was separated. וכפי משפטי התורה, אין ביד האדם שידו ביוצא פתח ביתו שיהיה פרושים. Even according to the Torah law, the person doesn't have that authority to say that whoever walks out of my house is not going to marry. It's not within the jurisdiction. כאשר אין בידו לעלותו עולה, just as much as God, man doesn't have the authority to make a person a human sacrifice. That's question number one. That's question number two. Question number two is even, I think, more biting. V'ima davar ken, if that was in fact the case, that she was celibate, that that's what it meant, hayta bito abocha al betuleh v'rayotea ima kizonot lekeles etnana. Means that when they're mourning, what are they mourning over? Why are they mourning? If, according to the Radak, this is a wonderful thing, this is sanctified life, this is elevated life, this is monastic life, and that's what we uphold and hail as something which is holy and sanctified, if, then why is she crying over her virginity, and why are the daughters of Israel on an annual basis coming to mourn? If you see the issue of marriage as something negative, then crying over it is horrible. On the contrary, that we should cry over serving God in purity. If that's how you understand the oath, then why are they crying? But you have to interpret the text literally, and I already explained what Yiftach's mistake was. So essentially we have two fundamental questions. Why? What is the nature of this oath that is so strange? How do you take somebody and designate them? Why would you do that? And number two, why are they mourning? What was the tragedy? If in fact that's Avodas Hashem, why are they mourning? Those are the challenges the Ramban asks on the Ibn Ezra, and that's really where we're at. We have two schools of thought, Ramban and Midrashei Chazal on the one hand, he's pagan and the result is pagan. The Radak, Ibn Ezra, Svarno, Mitzvot David, Mavarbanel, Malbim on the other, that says that some kind of monastic life was the meaning of this oath, and we have to interpret both the strangeness of the oath as well as the purpose of the mourning, the tragedy of the oath. All right, let's start with the oath, with the strangeness of the oath first, the first question of the Ramban. Everybody with me? Part of the issue here is that the oath itself seems to be so unprecedented or unparalleled. So in this next source, in source 6, which is a Medrash Rabbah, there's an interesting connection. Chazal, in this Medrash, looked through Tanakh and they found four instances where almost the precise formulation of this oath appears. And then the Medrash started to compare them. Succinctly, the Medrash says, Dalid hen shenadru. There are four instances of a vow to God, specifically, made publicly. Shnaim nadru v'hifsidu v'shnaim nadru v'nistakru. Two oaths were made in a manner in which the result was negative. They lost whatever it is they were trying to say. And two, oaths were made in such a way that they actually profited from the oath. What are the four instances of an oath? So we already know some of them. Yiftach is obviously one. What are the others? Chana is another. So the Medrash adds two more. Yaakov nadar. Yaakov took an oath. When did Yaakov take an oath?
Rachel.
No, before Rachel. When did Yaakov take an oath? Beit El, as he's leaving on his way to Lavan's house. By Yidar Yaakov neder lemor. After he wakes up from seeing the dream of the ladder. In your opinion, is that dream a positive statement? Or is that oath that he takes? What was his oath?
If he goes and comes in peace, he'll build a...
Then everything that God gives him... I will give a tenth to you. Aseret Esrei Nolach. right, the source of Maaser. Is that a good oath or a bad oath?
Good.
So explain to me why the Medrash says Yaakov nadar vehifsid, and he lost by it. Interesting, right? Okay.
Talking about Lavan?
No, he's talking about that oath. We're at the law. We'll see. I'm going to look at that in a second. Yiftach nadar vehifsid. So here, in one breath, I put Yaakov and Yiftach together. Remarkable. Who are the other two? Chana nadra v'nistakra. Chana's oath of her child. She certainly profited by it. She got a child. Yisrael nadru, and Israel took an oath. Where did Israel take an oath? So I showed you those psukim last week. In the Battle of Arad, after the Canaanites captured, kidnapped soldiers from Israel, v'yish mimenu shevi, v'yida Yisrael neder lemor. Israel took an oath, if you give them to my hands, I will destroy the enemy, v'acharamti arehem. And they were victorious. V'nistakru. So what I did was I took these four instances of an oath, and just to show you why Chazal picked these four in particular, I charted them out. And we've done this exercise before. I put them on the bottom of the page in four columns, and I tried to line them up so that you can see the formulation in parallel. So Yiftach is column 3. I did them in sequence in Tanakh. Yiftach is column 3. Vayda Yiftach neder laHashem vayoma. Im naton titen ebnei amon biyadi vaya yotze asher yitze midate beti lekvati b'shuvi b'shalom ebnei amon vaya laHashem ve'aliti ola. Clear? The closest of the four, the closest in language and context and formulation to this oath, is the oath in Bamidbar, the oath of Bnei Yisrael. It's the context is, what's the context there?
War.
Just as is Yiftach's oath. Vayida Yisrael neder laHashem vayomar. Starts with exactly the same formula. Im naton titen et ha'am hazeh biyadi. Exactly the same condition. If you will give them into my hands. The oath, however, is v'hacharamti et arehem, I will obliterate, I will destroy the enemy, I will destroy the cities. I won't take captives. I won't leave any alive. I will fight this war till the end. Meaning the context is the same, but the result is not only different, it's actually the opposite. In the oath of Bnei Yisrael, the subject of the oath is who is going to get it from the oath? Who is the subject of my oath?
Yeah.
The enemy. Yeah. In the context of Yiftach's oath, the sacrifice, the offering, the one who will pay the price for the oath is either Yiftach or Yiftach himself or his family. So that's certainly the opposite context of what Yisrael did, and therefore Chazal said, Bnei Yisrael were right. It's nadru ve nistakru, whereas Yiftach nadar ve hifsid, he lost by. Chana's oath is also formulated in a very similar fashion, and shares with Yiftach not the formulation of the condition, but the result. Yiftach offers his child. Chana offered her child. Vatidor neder vatomar shem tzvaot imraot tir'e ba'oni amatecha. If you will see my affliction, uzchartani, remember me, judge me, v'lo tishkach at amatecha, don't forget me, v'natata la'amatcha zera anashim. If you will give your maidservant seed, unitativ la'ashem koyimei chayav umora lo ya'aleh arosho. I will give him to God, I will make him a nazir, a razor will not come upon his head. Notice an interesting play on words here. The play on words is there's a connection between the condition and the oath. What's the condition? What does God have to do for the oath to for him to fulfill his half of the oath? Right, if you will see, that's all if, right? If, and what will you do if you see my affliction and remember me and not forget me, what will you do for me that I will respond with an oath? What is God, what's the condition of the oath?
To give him a son.
To give him a son, and the Hebrew phrase being? V'natata la'amatcha zera. V'natata la'amatcha zera. You will noten. You will give me a child. What will the oath consist of? Unatativ la'ashem. I will give him back to you. In other words, there's a direct connection between the condition and the oath. The condition is v'natata la'amatcha zera, and the oath is v'natati la'ashem. There's a logical connection between the condition and the oath. Unlike Yiftach, where there's no logic between the condition and the oath, because they're in the middle of battle, you're going to offer your daughter as a nun. What logic is there to connect?
If you didn't know who was going to walk out the door.
Especially if you don't know who's going to walk out the door.
That's what's so weird about the oath.
Secondly, there's another play on words, which I don't think is the Medrash referred to, but if you're already comparing Chana's oath to Yiftach, there's another word that plays in the parallel between the two oaths, or the contrast between them. This is more subtle. But in addition to taking the oath that she would make him, or designate him to God, give him back to God in some way, she adds a second oath to that. Umora lo yale arosho. Mora lo yale arosho means that no razor will come upon his head. Mm-hmm. But in typical biblical language, lashon nofela lashon, alliteration and play with words, the offensive part of Yiftach's oath is. What's the offensive part of Yiftach's oath? V'ha'alitihu ola. What's the praiseworthy part of Chana's oath? Umora lo ya'ale arosho. I don't think Chana intended for there to be a direct parallel to Yiftach. I think, although we're a long way off from discussing Chana, Chana's oath is actually much more connected to the story of Shimshon than to Yiftach. But Yiftach and Shimshon are contemporary, and we've already discussed. So there's the next generation after Yiftach. If Yiftach and Shimshon are contemporary, is Chana. So it's not quite as accidental as that. Which leaves us with the fourth, the most remarkable of all, which is Yaakov's oath. And the reason it's so remarkable is because we would normally interpret this as being a wonderful context, and Chazal were seem to be, at least in this Medrash, critical of Yaakov for it. What's Yaakov's oath? In the first column, Vayidar Yaakov neder lemor, im yeh Elokim imadi, if God will be with me, ushmerani baderech hazeh asher anochi olech, guard me, protect me. Why does he need to be guarded and protected? Who needs to be guarded and protected? Who generally needs to be guarded and protected?
Someone who's by himself.
Somebody's either by himself or?
It's weak.
Weak. Just being weak doesn't necessarily mean you need to be guarded and protected. Who typically we would say?
You have an enemy that's
wanted by. Right.
If an enemy wants to destroy you. In other words, In other words, when you are facing an enemy, who typically faces an enemy? Either somebody is on it, but that's not typical. Who typically faces? You go to war. When you go into battle, you face enemies, and therefore you need to be guarded. That's the bracha for Chayilei Tzal, is built on this language. Shmarani baderech hazeh asher anochi holech. In Yaakov's case, the war is not necessarily a military war, but a war for survival, and therefore the condition continues. V'natan li lechem la'chol u'veged l'bosh. V'shavti b'shalom. I should have put that in bold. What was Yiftach's oath? That the one who will greet me, who will walk out of my house, Asher yatzei midatei beiti likrati b'shuvi b'shalom. Yaakov's oath, v'shavti b'shalom. I go to war. If I come back from this war b'shalom, So here I have exactly the same context. Yaakov's going into war. Yitach's going into war. Yaakov takes an oath. This is the condition I will fulfill. This is the oath I will fulfill if God protects me, guards me, brings me home, survive, b'shalom. Yitach took the same oath. V'ha'even azot she'samti matzeva yebet Elokim. I'll make this place a mikdash, a sanctuary, an altar. Takes the even, makes it into a matzeva. Altar. We're getting remarkably close, right? V'chol asher titen li aser ha'asrenu lach. That which you give me, I will give a tenth to you. Maybe what does that mean?
A little shvach, because she gives her son back and he just gives a tenth.
Who gives the son back?
Chana. Maybe it's like you said, theirs was more, you know, like equal.
How do you give a tenth to God? What, do you take a tenth of every, all the cat, all the produce, and you, what do you do with it?
Give it to the temple.
You give it to the temple?
Or tzedakah.
Tzedakah? What were you intending when you said, Aser Esven Alach, I'll give a tenth to you? You take an even, you make a matzevah, you make a mizbeach, and then you say, God, whatever you give me, I'll give a tenth to you.
It's sacrificing.
Is there not an element of the danger on the slip of the tongue that Yiftach was guilty of? What's Yiftach guilty of? This generic, whatever walks out of my house, I'll give to you. What? And if a person walks out of your house? What's Yaakov saying? Whatever you give me, I'll give you a tenth back. What if I give you, I don't know, 10 wives? Are you going to give one back? What if I give you 10 children? Are you going to give one back? What do you mean, anything you give me, aser esrenu lach, I will give a tenth back to you? Said Chazal, Yaakov nadar v'hifsid. Now how did he lose? Did he lose with the death of Rachel?
Yeah.
Did he lose with the parsha of Dinah? Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer says he lost in the sense, although he doesn't understand it as a context of loss, but in Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, there's a flip side to this. He says, what is Aser Esrenu Lach? It doesn't mean property, and it doesn't mean cattle, and it doesn't mean money, it means children. So Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer says, and this is really, in order to give it a positive spin, much as the Radak was trying to give it a positive spin, says that Levi nitpas b'maaser, that Shevet Levi got caught in the oath of one-tenth. How did Shevet Levi get caught in the oath of one-tenth? Well, so in fact, Levi is designated to the temple, right? Levi is the Shevet given, but why is Levi the tenth? How did Levi get to be ten? Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, in sequence, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher, Yisachar, Zvulun, Yosef, and Binyamin are the 12 tribes. Where are we at? So when Yaakov returns from Laban's house, Binyamin's not yet born. Right? So I have 11 children. Where's Maaser? How did Levi end up? So the Medrash has the following cheshbon. It's really remarkable. It says, you take out the children of the Shvachot. Take out Bilhah and Zilpah. How many children are left? 7. Right? Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, Zvulun, Yosef. So now cycle them again. Just run through the cycle till you get to 10. Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, Zvulun, Yosef, Reuven, Shimon, Levi. Levi, nitpas b'maaser. In other words, at least according to the way Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer understood the Medrash, or understood the oath was, I will take one of my children and I will designate them to God. That says, that essentially is what I think the Medrash linked, how the Medrash linked Yiftach and Yaakov. Yaakov meant, in Yaakov's context, so designating Levi to God meant they would serve in the temple, they would dedicate their lives to the Kohanim, they would dedicate the Lemisharte Hashem Mishartei Mizbeach. But the notion of such a dedication is not foreign. a notion of an oath in the midst of battle. If you make me successful, then I will take one of my children and offer them as service to God. But Yiftach's problem was that maybe he misunderstood what service to God meant. Not quite as pagan as child sacrifice, but maybe he thought that meant that I would make her, put her into a context where she would live a monastic life, and that's pure form of dedication. That's essentially what the Radak is saying. But the parallel or the precedent for such an oath we would find, ironically enough, in Yaakov's oath. That's the remarkable part of this matter. Which brings us to the last piece of this, which is someone of you asked me before at the beginning of the class, why was it such a positive oath? Why would God have fulfilled? You asked this question. What's positive about this? According to the Radak and this school of thought, there's a positive element to this. What's motivating Yiftach in saying, in taking this oath? Why would God listen to him when he says in the middle of battle, the one who will walk out of my house, I will stick in a monastery? What motivation would God have to fulfill or to abide by or to spin in a positive way such a declaration? What's going through Yiftach's mind?
Maybe his belief in Hashem.
It's some perverted form of belief in Hashem, maybe. So up until now, I've shared with you everything that basically you'll find in the Midrashim and the Kru'ok Dalot and the classic sources. I'll share with you one piece of this that I think, that I heard from Rav Maidan, that I think adds a whole new spin to the story of Yiftach. There's one nuance here that we haven't picked up on yet. The oath is formulated in a particular way, and the fulfillment of the oath, or the fulfillment of the condition of the oath, is also formulated in a particular way. Go on the bottom of the page, you have all the psukim relevant. Take a look in column 3 where it says Yiftach. What's the oath? The condition of the oath is, Imaton titenet b'nei amon biyadiv, you'll give them into my hands. And the oath is, V'haya hayotzei asher yetzei midaltei beti likrati b'shuvi b'shalom b'nei amon v'haya la'ashem v'alati u'ola. That which will come out of my house when to greet me when I return in peace, I will offer to God. Let's go back to the question we started in the first class. What was he expecting to come out of his house? Who was he expecting to come out of his house? I'm not prepared to subscribe to the theory that he was expecting a cow or chicken to come out of his house. I mean, that's not.
Why?
Take a good look at that verse and you tell me why. Right. Right. Cows don't come out to greet me when I return home in peace. Vaya yotzei midaltei beiti likrati b'shuvi b'shalom.
Those people attached to dogs, a dog would be better.
Maybe, but the dog's not a kosher. But a dog's not a kosher animal either. And of the, and we have no indication that he had a dog. So, right.
What? The daughter's not a kosher.
Well, your daughter's not a kosher. You're not going
to
eat her.
So what? No, but again, according to the Radak, we're not talking about sacrifices. We're talking about some other context. But at least I understand the rationale of the statement. There's a logic to the statement that says, the one who'll come out to greet me. What's the issue with greeting me? So we could see that as a positive. The first one to come to greet me gets caught up in the, right? Or we could see it as a negative. The one who'll come to greet me when I return from battle, look at the oath as it gets fulfilled. Pasuk in the bottom chart. I'll show you. It's in the bottom chart where it says Yiftach in the middle. This is the actual verse, Pasuk Lamed Dalet. Vayavo Yiftach haMitzpah al Beito. Yiftach comes home. V'hine bito yotzet likrato. Of all of the phrases in the verse, the one that the Navi picks up on is likrato. V'haya yotzet mipetach bito likrato. Sorry, v'yavo yiftach mitzpah bito. V'hine bito yotzet likrato betupim uvimcholot. With timbrels and with dirt, circle dancing and with drums and with... And then the tragedy. Faraki yechida en lo mimeno ben obat.
He doesn't have
sons either, just... Oh, so that will... hopefully we'll get to that issue in a second, what the en lo mimeno ben obat means. So this I heard from Rav Maidan. This is really a remarkable insight. There's two parts of this verse that should catch our attention. One is the likrato. And the other? Vitupimu vimcholot. Think of the context for a second. Right. Think of the context for a second. He's coming home from battle. The battle's over. They were victorious. And to greet the victors, I have the women coming out bitupim uvimcholot to sing, to greet the victor. Where else have we had the women coming out bitupim uvimcholot in the aftermath of war? We'll get to David in a second.
Miriam.
Splitting of the sea. And that's Miriam. The right-hand column. Miriam. V'tikach Miriam ha-Nevia achot Aaron et ha-tof bi-yada. V'titzena kol ha-nashim achareha bitupim uvimcholot. V'tan lehem Miriam, shiru la-Hashem, ki go'o ga'a, sus v'rachvor ha-ma v'yam. It's exactly the same context. The war is over. Miriam brings the women out. Bitupim uvimcholot, same phrase. And they're singing, with one difference.
No singing.
We don't necessarily know that they're singing. I don't think they get to the singing, but there's an additional difference.
It's called a nashim.
This is also nashim. That's why I'm convinced. If this pshat is correct, I'm convinced that Yiftach knew whoever would come out of his house was going to be female. Now the only question is which female?
And because it was part of the protocol that after a war...
Correct, because it's protocol that after a war the women come out to bitupim uvimcholot, and I'll prove that protocol to you in a moment from David HaMelech.
So he was hoping it wouldn't be his daughter, it would be somebody else.
Well, we're going to see. Well, I'm going to show you what I was...
Who else
right,
was
right,
there?
Right. So that's what I'm going to show you in a second. But that's right.
Service?
But we haven't answered my question yet. What's the difference between the context of Miriam... in the context of Bat Yiftach?
Well, Miriam was praising Hashem.
Right. Miriam doesn't come out to greet the victors. Who are the victors in the story of Kriyat Yamsuf? Who's the warrior victor?
Hashem is
who she attributes it to, but who's the victor? Menesuel, more particularly Moshe. Who's standing there at the general at the top of the rock with the staff in his hand? Moshe. So she could sing to Moshe, which would be somewhat nepotistic, but okay, she could sing, or to Hashem. Shiru LaHashem, ki go'ogah. In other words, the whole context of Shirat HaYam in the aftermath of Kriyat Yamsuf was to set the record straight, to make it clear that the source of this victory belongs to God, Hashem Ish Milchama. And in fact, that's the purpose of Shira. We've discussed this in Sefer Yeshua. We discussed it in Shoftim as well. We discussed it by Shirat Devorah. The problematic nature of Shirat Devorah, because Devorah sings to herself. The problematic nature of Shirat HaMalachim in Sefer Yeshua, when Yeshua sings of 31 kings that he destroyed. Shira, when it's attributed to God, is praiseworthy, like David HaMelech. Shira, when it's attributed to the victors... is always problematic. And the focal point of that dilemma are the women who come out to sing the battle, to sing the victory, and dance the victory dance upon the return of the soldiers. To whom are they dancing? Right. Let's take a look at the third case. The third case of Tupim and Mecholot is David. And David, as he returns from the battle with the Plishtim, particularly with Goliath, Vahi bevo'am b'shuv David me'akot et ha'plishti. when David came back from fighting the Plishti, Vatetzena hanashim mikol arei Yisrael lashir, the women came out to sing, v'hamecholot, with the dancing, likrat Shaul HaMelech, there's that word again, likrat, who are they greeting? The king. Bitupim, b'simcha uveshalishim. And what did they sing? Vata'anena hanashim ha-mesachakot, vatamarna, the women sang and said, Hikash Shaul ba'alafav v'David b'rivvatav. Saul, thousands, and David, tens of thousands. That song is the beginning of the rift between David and Shaul, the beginning of a civil war that lasts not only the generation of David and Shaul, but ultimately is responsible for the split of the kingdom between Malchut Yudah and Malchut Yisrael, and a civil war that lasts in various formats for 400 years. Because they sang to the wrong victor. They would have sung to the Rabban Shlomo, and neither Shaul nor David would have bothered by it. This is the pshat that I heard from Rav Meidan. What's Yiftach's oath? What's Yiftach's oath in battle? God, give these people into my hands. Now reread the oath. V'haya hayotzeya sheyetzei midaltei beiti likrati b'shuvi b'shalom. The first one who comes singing to me, read to me and not to you, Ayala Hashem Valiti Ola, I will demonstrate to them, I will teach them for all eternity what designation to God, what devotion to God is about. And I will offer them as Hekdesh Hashem. And Nebuch, what he expected, what he hoped for, was that nobody would emerge from the house. At least not singing to him. You want to emerge from the house singing and dancing. Sing to the victor. Sing to God. That's a religious oath. That's an oath in battle that makes sense. And when he comes home, the result is, Vayavo yiftach ha-mitzpah beto v'nei bito yotzeit likrato. She comes singing to him. The tragedy isn't that she walked out of the house. The tragedy is what she was singing. Bitupim uvim cholot. And now Yiftach says, oh, my dear daughter, I have no choice. I made an oath. What was the oath? That the first person who sings to me in victory, I would make them a offering to God. Not in the altar sense, at least maybe not. Right? Maybe it was, if I go back to the first shot. Or, according to the Radak, at least some sort of lifestyle that would demonstrate to them that they have to devote their lives to God in some sort of perverted sense. And she says, that's the oath you took, so be it. But now at least it explains what was going through his mind, assuming that we give him the benefit of the doubt that this isn't a pagan ritual from start to finish. But to give it some context of legitimacy within the tradition of Jewish thought, then this would be the emphasis.
It's still very strange.
But what we haven't addressed, what we haven't addressed,
a very religious person.
Right.
But he hadn't educated her well enough.
Right. That's right. He's guilty of not educating her well enough. That is true. And up until now, what we've done essentially is try, to the best of our ability, to give him the benefit of the doubt. And the reason why I'm prepared to give the scoundrel the benefit of the doubt is because the real evil of Yiftach, and I've said this before, the real crime of Yiftach is actually, at least in the way the Tanakh presents it, is less here than it is in the next parak. Because, no, that's the battle with B'nai Ephraim. That's where he slaughters the tribe of Ephraim, 42,000 innocent souls. And there you really see the evil. There you really see the evil. We didn't address the second question of the Ramban, which is why there was, if this is correct, why are they mourning so? So I'll just give you the Cole's notes one line summation of that issue, which is the issue of en lo mimenu ben obat, which many understand to mean that he had no other children, or at least no other children from him, that his wife may have had other children, but there was no other heir except for her, which means that when she dies, Not only does she lose her legacy, but if she is his only heir, then if she dies, he loses his legacy, he loses an heir. And think about the way the story of Yiftach began. Why was he exiled?
Because
his brothers didn't want him to
inherit.
He comes back in order to regain his inheritance. And the result of his oath is that his only child, who is his heir to his inheritance, is destroyed. And so Yiftach ends in tragedy because he doesn't even have an heir. And that's the irony of the tragedy of Yiftach.
This is even stranger.
Uh-huh.
Weird story.
Oh, yeah.
Poor guy.